my name is Paul Weber, and this teleclass is titled A Plea for Simplicity, Observations, Opinions, and Ramblings of a Middle-Aged Infection Doctor. That middle-aged infection control doctor is Dr. Jim Hutchinson of Memorial University in beautiful St. John's, Newfoundland. Dr. Hutchinson is nothing less than a legend in Canadian infection control, indeed probably infection control worldwide. His lectures and his articles are always extremely popular. His fascinating blog gets thousands of hits, and I don't think he'd mind me saying that he is sometimes, well, actually almost always, of an irreverent disposition. He looks at things in a different way than most of us, which is perhaps why he keeps getting invited to speak at conferences and serve on committees and steering groups, more than I have time to mention. I will simply just say that it is a great honor to have him with us again. This is, in fact, his second teleclass presentation with us, and I'll let him get to it. From Memorial University in Newfoundland, I am pleased to present Dr. Jim Hutchinson. Jim.
Geez, that was an exceptional introduction, Paul. I don't think I can live up to that, but thanks very much. Anyway, I'm very happy to be able to present to whoever we have online, and I feel a little bit strange about talking about infection control issues because within my own realm, things have heated up so much in various ways that I've recently resigned as the clinical chief of the infection control program, so I feel like this might be my swan song in infection control. But anyway, this is a bit of a modification of a talk I've presented before. And for those that have seen me, I apologize somewhat. A plea for simplicity, and I mean this extremely sincerely, I really, really feel that infection control has gone down a path that needs to be corrected and needs to be simplified in a big way. What we are doing at present, the way infection control is growing, to me seems quite irrational. Go to the first slide. We have a beautiful picture of President Obama, and I wanted to speak a little bit about when I first showed this. This picture of the people I was speaking to, I only showed it to show you the next slide to say that I am older than the President of the United States. And when I was preparing for that particular thought, the thought crossed my mind that I could never say that before. And why that meant something to me is I know that soon what I have to say will be less relevant. And I think we all have to realize that as we go along, things always are changing and things, ideas change. But the President of the United States, I go back to his picture, I think it's very timely that healthcare reform has raised so many issues in the United States and so much debate on so many levels, not all of it even and not all of it positive, but it's debate. And I am firmly in the camp that this is only going to be for the positive in the general sense. If you go to the next slide, there is nothing more social than infectious disease. And the reason I bring that up is to go to the next slide to say vaccines only work if we all take them. What has that got to do with infection control? Well, I think the vaccine example is a very, very good one. The only way that we as people benefit from vaccines is if we get very large numbers of people to take them. And it's, if you think about vaccines, it's amazing that we, as large groups of people, were able to talk an extraordinarily large proportion of them to roll up their arms, let somebody stick foreign material into them for the benefit, potentially, of others. It's a very, very social undertaking. And I think the use of antimicrobials and the issues of antimicrobial organisms are very, very similar. We're only going to make headway in dealing with antimicrobials and antimicrobial resistance if we look at them as something we have to all do together. The next slide is a picture of one of my favorite, many people's favorite Canadians. And if it wasn't for this man, we may not have had Medicare. Tommy Douglas on the next slide is still right. And what I'm trying to say by that is that the principles of organizing ourselves to look after each other as a group as pertains to illness is correct. And in the construct of dealing with infections, it is exceedingly correct. The next slide is pretty central to my thesis of the whole talk. We already know how the bugs are transmitted. We don't need more studies. We don't need a lot more information to know how people get infections. We've known how people got infections for a long, long time. The problem is not knowing how they happen or how the microorganisms are transmitted. The problem is in dealing with the processes that get them transmitted. So the next slide, it's the people. It's the people we need to focus on and not the bugs. The bugs will be there. The bugs will always be there. It's the people and what they do that we need to focus on. Watch out for the little fellow with an idea. Your same man. If you go to the next slide. The reason that we're in the position we're in, debating whether we should, in Canada, it's interesting because as the debate rages on in the United States about the about healthcare reform, we've for many years been refighting the battle about privatization, reprivatization versus public delivery of healthcare. But Tommy Douglas, relatively single-handedly, with an idea, just an idea, and others in other parts of the world, changed the way that people organize themselves and look after each other. And I think in infection control, we're a little bit short on ideas at the moment. Go to the next slide. Principles are everything. Now, I think we've forgotten, I think we've lost sight of what the principles of dealing with microorganisms are. Coming to the next slide, which is something I feel very, very strongly everybody should consider. We can't cleanse populations of antibiotic-resistant organisms. We can't find the people that harbor them and then clean them away with other antibiotics. We can't wrap them up in plastic or ourselves up in plastic and make this circumstance go away. So this idea of finding the microorganisms, inhabiting the people, and then changing that circumstance by intervening more with antimicrobials is absolutely and utterly ridiculous. It is conceptually silly, completely silly. The next slide. Here's a slide, my first bit of data, maybe the only bit of data I'm going to show you. This is a slide that I've shown a number of times depicting penicillin-resistant Staph aureus evolution. Starting in 1942, before 1942, when antibiotics weren't available, the vast majority, or potentially all, I guess, of Staph aureuses were susceptible to penicillin. And then very, very shortly thereafter in the hospital setting, starting here in 1942-44, resistance started to increase. So penicillin resistance amongst Staphylococcus aureus increased in hospitals. And as you see, going all the way out to 1950, 52, 54, even out to 58, we were less than 20% in the community, but way up already by this time to 80, 90% were penicillin susceptible or penicillin resistant. So I assume that everybody out there will feel like this looks a bit familiar. This is exactly the same sort of evolutionary pattern that's been happening with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So now we're talking about community-acquired methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, which I guess would be analogous to the bottom line. But once we got out to 1976, and even probably before that, we stopped talking about community and hospital penicillin-resistant Staph aureus because everything was resistant to penicillin. And by the time I was in medical school, In the 80s, we certainly were taught that penicillin was an inappropriate and ineffective antibiotic for Staph aureus, and on we went. Well, the circumstance is just repeating, and I think if we have this, you hear a talk like this 10 or 15 years from now, we certainly won't be talking a whole lot about community and hospital methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. We'll be talking about something else, mind you. Go to the next slide. Many of you might recognize this fellow. I had a nice little animated slide that doesn't work in this setting, where this is Charles Darwin, and he was spinning around in his grave. I found a picture of his headstone. So Charles Darwin is more, the ideas of Charles Darwin are still very, very appropriate. In the case of antimicrobials and microbes, I think we've forgotten about them as well. If we go to the next slide, I love this one. This is a new representation of the Earth's biogeologic clock. And I'll take a little bit of time to explain this one to you. So on the right-hand side, around 3.5 to 4 billion years ago, it's thought that life became. So life as we know it started then, and life was bacteria. So bacteria started this 4 billion years ago, and you can see then there were phototrophic bacteria, the red bit, and then cyanobacteria, phototrophs, so they're able to make more energy out of light. And then, so now getting up to 2 billion years ago, eukaryotic organisms, which most people believe were inside bits of eukaryotes or have prokaryotic origin or bacterial origin, up to algae. And then you got to get all the way around to the top left here about 500 million years ago or so before you get the first sort of larger macroscopic organisms. And 400 million for plants. There wasn't even plants before then. You get up to the pink part being mammals, being, I can't even tell you exactly, maybe 100 million years of mammals. And then humans is the tiny little bit, so 2 to 4 million years humans have been on the Earth. And if you wanted to express the time that humans were on the Earth, where antimicrobials were in large distribution, say 60 or 70 years, you absolutely and utterly could not represent it on this. You'd have to blow this thing up to be about the size of the Empire State Building just to be able to represent it. So to give you the context of how long bacteria have been around, how long humans and bacteria have been interacting from the start of humans, from before humans, certainly, we have evolved with our organisms. And most of the organisms that we deal with on a day-to-day basis that cause disease are human-associated organisms. They are organisms that we've evolved with. So I think that bears much consideration. All right. The next slide is, and I hope that you're being impressed with the simplicity of the slides. I've helped you out with a little bit of bolding. If everyone had their own toilet, we would see little C. difficile. Now, that statement I'll stand by, and C. difficile, I'm sure in most of the parts of the world where I'm speaking to now, there's been increases in both the incidence and virulence of C. difficile. On the next slide, I've got the word simple underneath there. So there is a statement. If everyone had their own toilet, we would see little C. difficile. The next slide says, if everyone had their own toilet, we would see little anything. Well, what I'm trying to impress upon all of you is that if we simply gave people their own room and bathroom, we would see much, much less infections in hospitals or in any other care circumstance. So is that simple? Of course that's simple. Does that, everybody tells me that might be expensive. Well, I don't buy the expense anymore. I truly believe that in the construct of the modern Western model, that we've gotten over the hurdle that we should try to look after each other. We've got to look after people reasonably, and reasonably means having your own room. I've given people the analogy many times. So if you went to a hotel and you had to share a bathroom, how much would you pay for that room? Most people say, well, I wouldn't go in it at all. And I'm like, well, how much would you pay? I don't know, $30, $40. Yeah, okay, maybe I'd $30. So we're putting the sickest people amongst us in the wealthy, Canada is one of the wealthiest places on the history of the planet, in $30 hotel rooms when they're as vulnerable as they're ever going to be. It doesn't make any sense to me. put them in their own room with their own. We don't have to chase around the microorganisms. We just have to flush them down the toilet, as we already knew would stop other people from getting them. So, leads me to my main thought for the day. Simple is better. We need less messages. This is the slide. I had the most text on it. Simple is better. We need less messages. We need simpler messages. We need everybody to understand. And in our game, I guess that means the public needs to understand. All of these things we ask them to do, if they don't understand it, I think now about MRSA, and we have them go home and they ask you, can I go to the grocery store? Oh, of course you can go to the grocery store. You can't go to the cafeteria in the hospital, but you can go to the grocery store. And you can go to bingo, and don't worry about your husband, even though he's got, on dialysis, et cetera, et cetera. So these messages are impossible for anybody to understand. I mean, I can't explain them, so I have a tough time believing that they're going to be understanding them. The workers need to understand. So if you're trying to get a healthcare worker to do something, it should be something that they could wrap their head around, that, yeah, that makes good sense. I'm with you. If they don't get it, you're not going to get them to do it. The patients obviously need to understand. The doctors need to understand, because the doctors tend to be opinion leaders. And if you, in the way we've organized infection control in the last number of years, if you went to your average doc in the hospital and say, do you understand this, you'll get a lot of blank stares in a lot of places. It's become very complicated. The people, not the bugs. Next slide. So I believe that bug-specific policy or microorganism-specific policy is too complicated. And if it is too complicated, it's too difficult to explain. If it's too difficult to explain, it's way too difficult to enact. Then you got to engage specialists, and you got to engage all manner of other people. If you simplify it, you'll be able to operationalize it. So, next slide. I've got some of the messaging that we're developing for a campaign we were going to refer to as Simple Precautions. So, Simple Precautions every time, with the word simple underneath. Or next slide, arranged slightly differently. Or next slide, slightly differently. These sorts of messages, I believe, conjure up what I want healthcare workers and others to have in their head. I want them to think that there are things they can do all the time that are effective in preventing infection. The one that always is talked about is hand washing. There's many other things. So, next slide, I've got Simple Precautions TM. That's actually a lie. There's no trademark, but I thought it looked nice. A safety-inspired system infection control practices. Safety, of course, being a very large buzzword in hospitals or in healthcare, I guess, in general. A safety-inspired system infection control practice is based on people and processes and not on microorganisms. Use of scarce private rooms based on patient condition, not microorganism. Large focus placed on the processes of care with a in bold emphasis on universality. If you go out, or if I go out, and you say to people, what's universal precautions? They'll rattle it off. Well, you got to do it the same all the time with every person. So somehow, because universal precautions became this thing that prevented hepatitis and HIV, it's something we can't use the word universal. Well, I think we're making a big, big mistake with not using the word universal in many of our messaging. So what I propose is that we have much less messages, and that those messages are universal in nature. People understand the term universal. They understand that there's risks that you can't perceive, so if you do it the same all the time. They understand ritual. So all the time. Next slide. Concentration on the basics in all areas, with two words being the primary words that are used repeatedly, clean and safe. Those are words that conjure up for me what preventions of infections is all about. When people thought about hospitals in times gone by, they thought of white uniforms. These are symbols. They thought of all things being in order, safety, attention to detail. It's deteriorated. Things have deteriorated in our hospitals. We need to get back to them being basic, clean, and safe. So Simple Precautions, I'll say, is based on the current prominent documents in North America. Routine practices is what the documents referred to in Canada, or standard precautions in the CDC vernacular. They basically have very, very similar constructs. the idea on the, at least on the routine part and the standard part, I don't have any problem with the philosophy. Focus on re-education, but much more easy to understand. I'm proposing that the document, rather than being, I can't remember how many pages, 160 pages, is about 10 pages. Next slide is simple triage. This was something that I, actually this one is partly enacted. Trying to find a way to utilize the rooms in the most sensible way. You can agree or disagree with my hierarchy, but have known tuberculosis on the top where we have to use them for the airborne business, down through febrile neutropenia where these people really need to be apart for, so they don't get them themselves, large burns for the same sorts of reasons, large wounds for both reasons, getting stuff in and getting stuff out, rashes, especially if they got if they're potentially infectious, diarrhea. We've had extremely good success in keeping C. difficile rates down in our institutions by a very active program of isolating people with diarrhea at the first instance of diarrhea. So again, a universal approach to the dealing with diarrhea. And then, see, right down on the bottom was the no one MRSA with none of the above. What's happening now with more and more people colonized, we're ending up with more and more private rooms filled with people that are simply colonized with MRSA, but are, you know, not they don't have anything else, they might have a cardiologic problem or whatever. And the scarce rooms, we end up putting people with big wounds, et cetera, in multi-bed rooms. Makes no sense to me. Next page is an image of the routine practices document from Health Canada. And the next slide has something I took out of a page. So hand washing has been a big deal of late. There's been world campaigns and national campaigns, etc. I find them a little bit paternal, to be honest with you. I have no argument that people should be encouraged to wash their hands. But if you look at this document, hands should be washed, must be washed after direct contact, and all of this text, before contact, after contact, before performing invasive procedures, after contact with blood, bloody fluids, after contact items known to be, etc., referenced. Simple precautions in the next page says this: before all care, wash. If we could universally instill the message that each time you're going to do something, this is what I tell medical students when I'm teaching them. I spent a fair bit of time in primary care before specializing. And when I was working in primary care, there, I'd have three examining rooms, each of them with a sink in it. When I walked in the door, I went to the sink. I'd say, "Hello, Mrs. Smith, how are you doing today?" as she sat on the bench, and I'd wash my hands while she washed me. She didn't wash me, while she watched me wash. Anyway, I'd be washing away. I'd do most of my interview of what Mrs. Smith's problem was, rinsed them off, went over and did the business. The next time I went in the next room, I went straight to the sink. "Hello, Johnny, what's your trouble today? You have a cough, etc." And that was my routine. That's exactly what I do when I go here. But the reason I explain it that way is that sometimes I'd forget to wash after I did it, but I never forgot to wash when I went into the room to deal with the next one. I always at least washed once. It was ritual. It was very much like how I think people still view the operating room. Ritualistic. When I walk in the room, I go directly to the sink. Every single time. Simple. A couple more messages. Soap, water, simple. Clean, safe, simple. I've envisioned a process whereby there's actually some very cool stuff now where you can message on this material that adheres to the wall without it being stuck onto the wall. You guys, they're often on glass things in businesses. Anyway, I had envisioned that we could put these messages in strategic places and rotate them so that someone would be looking at it one day and it would be one message, and then they'd look at it the next day and I thought that said something slightly different the next day, in order to reinforce the kind of these messagings. Wash your hands, all your friends are. I like that one. Simple precautions prevent infections. Simple precautions every time. Help make the hospital neat as a pin. That's a bit of a Newfoundland or British-ism. The reason I like that one, actually, to digress a little, is that the idea of everybody pitching in, I think, is also central to infection control. We've compartmentalized this so much that everybody, the cleaner is the only person that can clean, and the infection control practitioners are the only one can do this. I really think we've done ourselves a disservice. I think we've got to get back to everybody is responsible for the whole place being in order. And if that means picking something up or if that means putting something back, fair enough. And if we keep encouraging people to take ownership of their smaller bits, I think we'll get back to a better spot. Clean, safe bathrooms, next one. Everybody can help. Again, back to the principle I was getting at. Fight infections, wash your hands. You can have a billion of them. All right. So that was how I thought we would proceed. It hasn't quite gotten there yet, but you understand the principles, I hope. Bare below the elbows. This is one we have just enacted, actually, and I think it has been absolutely exceptional and positive in all ways. So an excellent way to symbolize change towards universality and towards simplicity. There's nothing to it. You don't have to explain why people have to have their forearms visible to be able to wash. When we were medical students or nurses and we had to go to the operating room for the first time, it was all scary because it was so ritual and someone would get mad at you if you didn't do things exactly right. And we were taught exactly how to scrub and how long and your nails had to be a certain way, et cetera, et cetera. Well, then you start doing it each time when you go to the operating room, that's how you do it. Well, they understand that. And one of the messages we were using is, let's bring the scrub to the floor. You got to do it well, and you got to do it each time. So the other thing I really, really like about this is that the person themselves, the individual who we've been chastising for not washing their hands, doctors only wash their hands 30% of the time, blah, 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 they can all demonstrate to anybody that they're in. They can have their sleeves up. They can have their arms out. They can have their rings off and watches off. They can be like that anytime they want. I got at the bottom there, a start towards institution-laundered uniforms. I know they've made big strides in Britain and in North America, well, certainly in Canada. We are so far away from institutional laundry now that it'll take a long time to get back. But I really think in the next phase of redevelopment of healthcare structures and institutions in Canada, we've got to get back to institutional laundering. So a few more messages around that one. Elbows out. Show some skin like that one. Little elbows are in. And then I know there's some British people on the line, but for those that didn't know about this one, this is a big movement in Britain at the moment, kind of coming out of the large-scale politicization of MRSA and C. difficile in particular. Doctors' white coats to be banned. I think that's already occurred in certain circumstances. An image of some nurses in, or some healthcare workers, I guess, in the new standard uniforms. The next page had NHS Scotland's uniforms. The uniforms are for several reasons. One is to identify which kind of person you're dealing with. That's been a big issue in hospitals for many years. The patients and the visitors trying to figure out who's who because there's no identification by uniform. So there's more than just infections that are that uniforms are useful for. You see on their using fob watches. Well, remember, nurses always had fob watches. The reason they did was so they didn't have watches on their wrists so they could wash their hands. We went away from it. Why did we go away? I don't know why we went away. But I think we've got to go back towards. There's actually a company in Britain making infection control washable fob watches for nurses. I can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head. But anyway, they'll put your own logo on them, et cetera, et cetera. I thought they'd be an excellent kind of a gift for someone that did well in infection control as an inducement. Jewelry off, next slide, clean. Simple wristwatch off. So these kind of messages could be placed on the doors of the lounges or the main gathering areas where healthcare workers were, reinforce them. So I think the idea of simple, repetitive, rotating messages potentially would be, again, messaging in this day and age has to be brief, has to be, again, people are very much into clicking on mouses, seeing very small images in a fleeting time. So I like the idea of putting these in a good spot, make them look modern. Here's an example going further. There are some examples of some very specific ones you might think of. A big problem people have relayed to me many times through the years, oh, this person came out and they answered the phone with their gloves on or they typed on the computer. So gloves off, they need to be off. So gloves off before leaving the room. That could be on the inside of the door on and particular places where procedures are done or whatever. Blood pressure cuff wiped. Put that in certain places where the blood pressure cuffs are. Stethoscope wipe. This is one we try to harp on the medical students all the time. Maybe that should be on the door of the place where they go every morning to gather or something like that. And maybe even parceled up with some alcohol wipes that would be beside the sign or whatever. Take me to your washer. I changed that recently to take me to your incinerator. Because I think the white coat should be gone. I think they've gone the right direction in Britain, and I understand in some other places, but I think we've got to take those strides in Canada and other parts of the world. Sharps container full, another big issue at times. New mop head. All manner of things to do with infection control are hard to operationalize. We have processes where if somebody's in an isolation room, they get a new mop head. If they're not in an isolation room, they don't get a mop head. Well, I don't know about in your places, but in mine, the number of turnover of people that do the housekeeping is enormous. Just trying to get them to follow all the multiple disparate protocols based on microorganism in differing rooms is daunting. Get back to structures, engineering ways to clean the rooms the same all the time. I don't profess to know exactly what the right way is, but I know that if you did it the same way all the time and you potentially went with these washable mop heads, that it would make things easier and likely a whole lot more effective. Antibiotics on time, all manner of evidence that if we give people antibiotics for particular surgeries at the right time, that they don't get infections, we don't give it to them. Which does lead me to the intersection of infection control and the safety movement, which I'm very much a proponent of. In Canada, we have a nationally funded program called Safer Healthcare Now. It was patterned almost identically after the IHI in the United States 100,000 Lives campaign, but the principles are all very similar. We've already identified the places whereby infections occur. We then measure that those things, or we encourage or find the ways to get those things to happen well. We measure that they've happened well, and then we let the bugs fall where they may. I'm more than happy with that sort of approach. In Canada, at least, there's been a big headbutting from the safety people with the people in infection control about turf, about whatever. But I think it's time that that infection control went towards the true prevention model, which is the safety model. Figure out how it's likely to happen and fix that up and measure that you fixed up the processes. The outcome measures in infections are really hard to measure. Suctioning, goggles on, safe, again, you get the picture. So no touch technique, high touch surfaces wiped, ultrasound gels. We had a big problem with contaminated ultrasound gel where we tried to put in a process to say they had to be thrown away after a specified period of time. Head of bed up from the point of view of the ICU, ventilator-associated pneumonia, disinfectant potency check. There's all manner of things that we could message. Run through the scope channels. Sick shouldn't visit. The message to the public: don't get too wound up about exactly which kind of sick they might be. Just tell everybody all the time, repetitively, if you're unwell in any way, don't come to the hospital. Then we have a picture of St. John's to calm me down a little here. Right. So. My main message, I think, has probably come clear that what is needed is to rethink what infection prevention is, to push it towards the prevention side of it, which is admitting that we know the ways that infections occur. Another example, for instance, we know how central line infections occur. They occur at the time of placement. There's all manner of evidence to show that if you put them in surgically aseptic way by skilled individuals, that they almost never get infected. Well, the effort then has to be in on finding the way to make the structures, to have the skilled people, to have the surgically aseptic conditions adhered to during line placement. Not spend all the effort on measuring how many people got line-related infections. And I think that there's another very good example of universality of insertion ends up with perfect outcome. You don't have to decide which people to do this well on. You do it well all the time. It's the same with every one of the processes that we talk about from infection control, whether right from cleaning of the building all the way through to surgical technical procedures. All right, so that is what you're looking at if you're still looking at the St. John's picture. I took that picture up near Signal Hill. That's looking at downtown, and then I made it all stylized, blew the color up a little bit. But it actually does look like that, not quite that vibrant color, if you were looking at the color version. The next slide has guidelines for design and construction of healthcare facilities, which is a book from an association of architects in the United States, which is one of the only, there's very few guidelines that are specific for healthcare design. And the reason I left that slide up was to remind me that one of the biggest simple answers to infection control is engineering, and that all of us in infection control have to be part of the lobby for better structures for treating patients, be they acute care or long-term care patients. And if we spend the money on the front end in making reasonable structures with a one-bum, one-toilet formula, and make it the law, and this, it certainly can be made the law. Remember in times gone by, we didn't have laws in the West Coast of the United States for how to build buildings, and when there were earthquakes, they all fell down. Well, we made laws that said they had to conform to X standards that would stop them from falling down. We used to have houses burning all the time because electricians could put in any kind of wires in any kind of way. We made building codes that said you can only put in this kind of socket and this kind of breaker, and it has to conform to this kind of code, and it has to be inspected. So then we had no more problems with, or much less problems with houses burning down because we had code. I think the same thing could occur in acute care facilities. If we had law that said the minimum requirement is one toilet per one patient, then when you got into the process of doing the budgeting and the et cetera, the planning for the building of the institute of the hospital, that we wouldn't be bogged down in any way about having to comply with the law, just as we have to comply with the law for the plumbing and the in the general sense and the electricity, etc. So my last couple of slides: Canadians can afford a toilet for their sickest citizens. Well, of course they can. And in fact, the last one says Canadians can't afford not to provide. And again, these infections are not super complicated. They really aren't. They happen because of things that are predictable. If we make reasonable buildings, if we make reasonable and thoughtful universal structures for processes, we can have very, very positive effect on the health of all of our people. The last one, the last slide is a screenshot of InfectionNet. In fact, InfectionNet is at www.infectionnet.org, and this is actually the first version, and it's going to morph a little bit within a month or two into something that looks a little bit different, but has some different functionality. anyway, it's got a little blog component, and I've stuck a couple of things I've written on the topic. Some of them are oldish, but you can read if you want to think more or read more about what I was thinking when I was talking today. You can have a look there. There's a few other things there you might be interested in. There's some under the button course material. There's all the notes that I give to the first and second year medical students I teach are there if you're interested in that. And if you come back in the next little while, I've got a few new twists with InfectionNet that I'm hoping I can engage people to have more discourse on these sorts of issues. Anyway, I'll stop there, and thanks very much for the opportunity to vent a little bit, maybe, and hopefully induce a bit of thought.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. I think the last time that I heard you vent was over a beer in St. John's last May, and it's amazing what you come up with and come out with it. Some of your ideas, they're, I should say, absolutely simple, and I dare say that people who have been nursing for a great many years will think back to their early days and say, well, yes, that's the way we used to do it. And why don't we do that again? And I think you're absolutely right. As you were speaking, I reached across to the most recent issue of the American Journal of Infection Control. There's an article in there by Dick Zoutman and his group called Exposure to Hospital Roommates as a Risk Factor for Healthcare-Associated Infection.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the article goes on, and they have confidence intervals and all sorts of things. But he closes by saying that while it has been argued that this type of hospital is more costly to build, private rooms result in cost savings that, when amortized over 30 years, recoup the original capital building cost many times over. I guess it just requires the courage of some budget holder to start building hospitals with exclusively private rooms. Yeah, I think that's probably happening now, isn't it?
It's just starting. It is starting, and but it seems unbelievable to me that we have to create the evidence to suggest that putting the sickest amongst us with various kinds of infections in the same room is potentially bad for them. And it's well known, and there's lots, but we create this new evidence with p-values, et cetera, and it's starting. There's a hospital that's to be opened in Victoria next January that is about 85%, I think, private rooms. A few of the new facilities in Ontario went quite a bit up in number. I think there's some new buildings being built in Britain that are getting closer. So I think the message is starting, but I think it behooves the infection control community to be a stronger part of the lobby, right? I'm on Dick's side, but I don't think we've been very organized. I don't think we've been as strong a lobby as we might be. There's a very large number of people that work in this game now, and I just think that the solution to most of our problems, the solution to most of the problems are structural. We don't need more people running around measuring more infections, chastising more people for not doing their processes right. We need better places to do them and then better structured ways of getting them done so that the right way to do it is always the way it's done. But it's, you know, I think tide is turning somewhat. But you have to keep the pressure on. But I think this idea of code is excellent. Once you ensconce in law that acute care facilities have to have a minimum of, you know, whatever, then that's code. Then when you start your process, you have to conform to code. The budget comes in, has to conform to code.
Right.
So I think that kind of a way of getting it into the law would be exceedingly helpful because we'll discuss it at the higher level, and then we'll find the money. And as Dick said, this amortization, I mean, I've been involved in costing out hospital infections in various ways, right? They're very expensive.
Yes.
But it's not just that they're expensive. People dying. These are dead people. We're not just costing out. So to say that we are... to say that we're saving the amount of money we'd have to borrow over 30 years many fold is definitely true. I think it can be defended in all manner of ways, but we're also stopping people from being dead. And that is central to this. I just think that if it gets to we need the politicos with the might. We need the Obama to take on the issue, right? And Canada's had a dearth of ideas at the high level, I think, in the last number of years, decades maybe.
Prime Minister Hutchinson, I like the sound of that.
I don't.
Well, listen, thank you very much for this. I know that there are questions, and I'm not going to be able to take the phone off of mute.
www.infectionnet.org, there is a little thing that says Ask Jim, which just gets you onto my email address.
So again, Jim, thank you very much. It was a really interesting presentation. It was more than an interesting presentation. It was a brain-stimulating presentation, and not all of the lectures that you hear at conferences get your brain going. Some of them pull it firmly into park, but yours was exceptional. Thank you very much for that.
That's a big compliment. Thanks very much.
And to everyone who has joined us, thank you as well, and we will talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.